This is Place Matters, a podcast at the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to Season 6, Voices from the Field, where we speak with historians, researchers, authors, and thought leaders whose work is shaping the field of place-based development. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting for FCS and the host for Place Matters. In 1906, the state of Georgia was in the throes of a highly contentious governor's race. As publishers and editors of Atlanta's two major newspapers, the two candidates used their separate platforms to essentially out-racist each other. Promoting racist tropes in the news did more, though, than activate their political bases. It laid down the kindling, poured gasoline, and handed the public a match. Lies about black men assaulting white women was the spark that led to a race massacre that spread throughout the city and ended in FCS's neighborhood, which at the time was known as Brownsville. And unfortunately, Atlanta is not alone or unique in being a site for white terrorism and racist violence against the progress, success, wealth, and self-determination of black people and their communities. Another one of the United States race massacres took place in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the Greenwood neighborhood, which at that time was known as Black Wall Street. Home to small businesses, schools, newspapers, houses, restaurants, theaters, and more, the vibrancy, bustle, and beauty of Greenwood in the 20th century was a testament to the power and brilliance of black leadership in Tulsa. And much like Atlanta, anti-blackness and white supremacy would eventually rise up and seek to destroy this amazing neighborhood. Why? What causes actions like this, and what are the impacts of them? And how did Greenwood rise from the ashes? And are there implications for us today, 100 years after this evil tragedy? Joining me today is Victor Lukerson, the author of a book that tells the origins and wonders of Greenwood, the pains and evils of the massacre, and the struggle to survive and thrive in its aftermath. His book, Built from Fire, is a must-read for anyone interested in understanding the power and importance of our historically black neighborhoods and in learning how to protect and preserve their place in our cities. Victor is a journalist whose work has appeared in Time Magazine, The New Yorker, The New York Times, Wired, and The Smithsonian. Listen in as we talk about the neighborhood that refused to be erased. Victor, thank you so much for making time for this conversation. Even more importantly, thank you for this project that you have labored on and put together to share with the world. I'm just super excited to talk to you about it today. So thank you for being on.
Thanks so much, Sean. I'm happy to be here. Really excited to connect with ATLian as well, actually. I used to live in Atlanta. So
There we go. That's so cool to know there's a connection to Atlanta. I'm excited to hear a little bit more about that. So before even talking about this beautiful work you've pulled together, I am just curious about what brought you to the place to want to take this on. This is an incredibly comprehensive, robust project. I'm just kind of curious, like from your own personal, professional journey, what made you say, you know, this is going to be something I put my heart and mind to?
Well, you know, Sean, I've always wanted to be a writer from the time I was 5 years old. I'm actually from Montgomery, Alabama, and I remember just tooling around on my parents' typewriter when I was five, just always knowing that writing was going to be what I wanted to do. I think for me, originally it was telling stories, you know, short stories and that kind of thing. But when I was in college at University of Alabama, I realized that journalism was a really powerful way to tell stories in a way that could impact the world in a really direct way. So really, it was when I was at the University of Alabama is when I really first started diving into journalism, but also into history and the way that you could use journalism to uncover history in a lot of ways, you know. I know, for example, when I was at UA, at the time I was there in the late 2000s, you would hear a lot about the standing in the schoolhouse door, the famous moment with George Wallace. Tried to stop two black students from attending the school, but ultimately he was stopped by the National Guard and Robert Kennedy and all these folks. And so I remember, you know, knowing that narrative when I was a young person, but then not knowing anything about authoring Lucy, a black student who actually went to UA before that, and was chased off campus by the Ku Klux Klan and a white mob. It was kind of one of these buried stories of black history in our state that I didn't know anything about until I went to Bama. And so that was kind of my first introduction, I think, to using journalism to uncover aspects of the past that some folks don't want us to know about. You know what I mean? And yeah. So for me, I think you fast forward to the last few years, I was able to sort of translate that interest to the story of Tulsa, the story of Greenwood. And so, you know, for me, I think that I was really curious about sort of excavating more of Black history beyond the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. You know, I mentioned that I used to live in Atlanta. And so actually this whole project started for me back in 2017. I was living in Grant Park. And one of my friends came to visit. We were having lunch in Grant Park one day. And my friend, he actually mentioned the fact that he had never seen the film 12 Years a Slave. You know, that's one of those movies that, you know, it's very prestigious, great movie. You kind of like supposed to see it in some ways, you know. And yep. My friend said he didn't want to watch it because he was tired of only seeing Black folks being brutalized, you know, in historical depictions. Mm. And so I asked my friend, have you ever heard of Black Wall Street? That's an example of us being successful. My friend had never heard of it. And this was back in 2017. Wow. So that's like before Watchmen, before President Trump and President Biden visited Tulsa. You know, it was still kind of a relatively mm-hmm. unknown story at the time, kind of like the story about the Black student in Alabama, like I said earlier. And so I think it was really kind of that moment of realizing that a lot of young folks my age had no idea about Greenwood's story, not only the trauma of the race mm-hmm. massacre, but also the prosperity and solidarity and beauty of what they built together. And so really it was from that moment actually in Atlanta and Grant Park that I really decided that I wanted to pursue this and really dive deep on trying to tell the full story of Greenwood.
Oh, wow. 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 That's, fascinating to think about something of such substance and power being relatively unknown.
Sure.
And so, I mean, you obviously knew of the story before starting the project, but as you dug in as deeply as you did, like, how did your own understanding of Greenwood evolve throughout the process of this project?
Yeah, almost kind of went in three phases for me. You know, I think that the first phase was kind of like I said, really wanted to tell people like my friend Check an example of Black success that we weren't getting anywhere else historically, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think when I first started the project, I was really interested in highlighting all the entrepreneurial success and financial success and really trying to sort of explain what was sort of the secret sauce of Black Wall Street, as we say, mm-hmm. that really brought these Black folks so much prosperity. And I actually remember back in Atlanta when I was first starting the project, I would read the Tulsa Star every morning before my regular job. And so the Tulsa Star was this Black newspaper in Greenwood in the early 1900s before the race massacre. And I remember going through the paper every day at my kitchen table and being really surprised that my vision of prosperity wasn't quite matching up with the facts, you know? Like I'd be reading this newspaper and they'd be talking about how the roads were not paved in Greenwood, how there were no lights in Greenwood, how there were all these challenges they were facing because they weren't getting the resources they needed from the city of Tulsa. And so I think that really forced me to really kind of reconceptualize exactly what the book was going to be about. And so I think from there, I really sort of realized that I really had to be able to craft a story that told the good and the bad. And also, I think that really tried to humanize the people there. You know, I think at first I was really hoping to be able to almost create these heroic figures, you know, superheroes mm-hmm. almost. Mm-hmm. I do think the folks, mm-hmm. so much what happened in Greenwood is heroic, but it's in a very human way. And so I think over time, my goals with the book became much more about humanizing the people there as opposed to sort of just simply valorizing them.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's part of what happened to me and reading through your work was like the beauty was more beautiful and the tragedy was more tragic. I mean, at some level, like I knew enough to know this Black Wall Street and like being in Atlanta and Sweet Auburn and like being in historic South Atlanta where there's this history of like Du Bois taught at Clark and was in the neighborhood. Like, so there's enough awareness like that I knew of that. And there's also enough like race massacre in Atlanta, race, you know, 1921 and Tulsa. So had knowledge of it, but kind of going through this, just being both like the intimate nature of the, like, it's very comprehensive, but also intimate. You're great. You're a great writer, by the way, I just felt so connected to people. And I think like
Lula Williams was, I think, my favorite, just like thinking about the theater and just her being this like badass businesswoman doing all this kind of work in the neighborhood. So just, I think the tragedy was much more profound than, I mean, I knew what I was going to be getting into, but I didn't know what I was getting into. And also the depth at which you presented the power and the strength of that neighborhood was also pretty overwhelming at times. So I'm curious for you, like, was there I mean, as a journalist, like you love probably digging into these newspapers was probably a big part. But was there a person or a story or a component of Greenwood that was your kind of surprising favorite or something as you went through the process?
That's a good question. I feel like for me, as a journalist, actually, A.J. Smitherman was a really amazing person to learn about. So A.J. Mm-hmm. Smitherman was the editor of the Tulsa Star, the black newspaper, before the race massacre. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think just learning about another journalist from a different era who like truly brooked no compromise, you know, that was really powerful for me to just see that he was such a principled person. For example, lynching was a huge problem in Oklahoma and across the Deep South in the early 1900s. And Smitherman had several columns talking about how no one deserved to be lynched, whether they were white or black, rich or poor, even if they're accused of a crime credibly. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we have a justice system to work those things out. And so that really just spoke to me on a journalistic level, I think. And then actually I got to meet a lot of A.J. Smitherman's descendants as I wrote the project. So, A.J. Smitherman survived the race massacre, but he was essentially accused of inciting a riot by the city of Tulsa and the state government. He actually left as a fugitive and was banished to Rochester, never to return. Sorry, to Buffalo, New York, rather, never to return to Tulsa again. And so his family's still in Buffalo. So I actually went to Buffalo, met his family, and sort of got their perspective on what not only all he had accomplished, but, you know, sort of that lingering trauma of having, his livelihood destroyed and having that never be resolved. You know, there's never been justice provided anywhere for anyone in Greenwood. And so I think for me, there are so many powerful individual stories like that of people who accomplished so much. Had it ripped from them, and you know we're still dealing with the ramifications of that today. But for me, I think Smitherman, I'm a writer, he's a writer, so that really resonated with me. You know,
Wow. How did Greenwood become Black Wall Street? Right. I'm thinking like we're not that far removed from the Civil War's ending. It's still like late 19th, early 20th century, and you've got this like epicenter of black business and wealth and community and vibrancy. How does that even come into being in that era in Oklahoma?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's kind of two major factors. One, people might be able to guess, involves kind of like the great migration dynamics. You know, so many black folks were leaving in the Deep South in the early 1900s, seeking to escape being under the heel of Jim Crow. You know, in the book I write about the Goodwin family who were living in rural Mississippi in the early 1900s in a town called Water Valley, where a white or black man was expected to scurry into the gutter when a white man walked towards him on the sidewalk. J.H. Goodwin, the family patriarch, wasn't having it, you know, so the family, you know, they had so many options of where to go, but they chose to go to Tulsa as this kind of new, almost black Mecca that people were talking about. You know, black folks actually called it the Eden of the West at the time. And so you have a lot of very ambitious black migrants from the Deep South. But then when they come to Oklahoma, they actually meet this other group of black people who are already there. People might be less aware of the actual indigenous dynamics involved with black history in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
A lot of black people were actually owned as slaves by the indigenous tribes before the Civil War. And they're actually black folks on the Trail of Tears who walked from the Deep South to Oklahoma in the 1830s. And so you have this black population that actually was seated in Oklahoma alongside indigenous people. And after the Civil War, these black folks became members of all the tribes in Oklahoma. And so they basically had they ended up having a lot of wealth from tribal wealth, basically, while living out there. And so a lot of these black folks in the tribes who were citizens wanted to recruit other black people to come out there. And so you had on the one side these sort of black folks with tribal wealth in Oklahoma. And on the other side, you had these black folks seeking to find a better life outside of the Jim Crow South, and it ended up being a perfect match in Greenwood.
Yeah, that was, of the many things that were revelatory through the process, that part about the indigenous and black communities kind of wovenness from jump. I never had anyone talked through that or had I read through that before. So incredibly fascinating to see the way those histories were intertwined. Pretty fascinating to see that. So you've got Greenwood, this like epicenter of wealth and vibrancy, while still being like under-supported, underfunded, ignored largely by the city powers. So what happens in 1921 to spark what became the race massacre?
Yeah, so I always like to say that, you know, the events of 1921 were really more sparked by the events of 1907. In 1907, yeah. Oklahoma became the 46th state, and actually the very first law that was passed by the state government segregated train cars in Oklahoma. And so there was really this huge battle playing out in Oklahoma when it became a state about what kind of state it was going to be. I've always thought it was very tragic that a place outside the Deep South literally decided to import Jim Crow policies to this place. And so, you know, even at the time, President Teddy Roosevelt was asked by black Oklahomans to not allow Jim Crow. He ultimately, you know, declined the offer and let Oklahoma do what it wanted to do. And so that, you know, that I think that legal distinction ultimately kind of seeded a sociological perception of black people in Oklahoma being lesser. And so when you fast forward to 1921, we've now been in a Jim Crow state for 14 years. We're living in a time when there's a lot of economic competition between black and white residents for jobs. And also there is sort of an increasing paranoia among white people about black men fraternizing with white women. And so when you sort of take all that stew together, you wind up with an event on May 30th, 1921, when a black shoeshine boy named Dick Rowland went to try to go to the bathroom in a building in downtown Tulsa. He steps on an elevator with a white attendant named Sarah Page. As they go up on the elevator lurches. Dick Rowland loses his balance, grabs her arm or something like that. Sarah Page screams. Dick Rowland runs away. And ultimately, he ends up being falsely accused of attempting to rape Sarah Page. Dick Rowland was arrested that night, and the next day, a very large white mob forms around the courthouse to try to take Dick Rowland from the jail and potentially lynch him. Now, lynchings were actually, like I said, pretty common in this era, even in Oklahoma, as well as in the Deep South. And I think that, you know, there have been so many earlier examples of white mob successfully lynching folks in Oklahoma. But in this case, I'm sure that those folks are very surprised that a group of armed black men from Greenwood actually came to the courthouse to defend Dick Rowland, which was a huge sort of like disruption of the power dynamics that had been established not only in that city, but, you know, across America for centuries. And ultimately, one of these black World War One veterans and a white man from the mob ended up fighting over a gun. A gunshot went off. Chaos erupted in downtown Tulsa. And so on this night of May 31st, there was actually shooting throughout the streets between black and white residents. It was almost like a little bit like warfare in downtown Tulsa. And essentially, because of this act of black self-defense that happened on that night, white Tulsa decided to burn Greenwood wholesale the next morning as punishment and sort of like, I think really it was about sort of trying to impart to the black community they could never dare to defend themselves in that way. And so on that next morning of June 1st, up to 5,000 white people armed themselves with guns, torches, kerosene, matches, and they ended up destroying Greenwood wholesale. You know, they destroyed more than 1,200 homes, several hundred businesses, as many as 300 people were killed, and ultimately it was the worst incident of racial terror in American history.
You know, the profound layers of tragedy throughout all of that. You know, there was a part that both was completely expected and also shocking at the same time. Like when at the courthouse steps, the sheriff of the police department is deputizing white residents, like, and just handing out weapons, like, and which is just at like a whole nother level of like, you know, like there's one level of awareness of like, yes, law enforcement has stood against the black community and not for its own protection or its well-being, right? And but to this visual of just guns being handed out and random people just being deputized as just white men to go execute murder and violence just throughout was Yeah, I just remember kind of setting the book down and just like, I don't know what I, something, just said something out loud of just at the shock of like, oh my gosh, the level of state sponsoredness in all of this. Like, because I think me going in, I'm picturing probably what a lot of uninformed folks are picturing is like, it's just a mob of angry white people, you know, just kind of going out and just creating violence. But maybe the law enforcement kind of standing in the background and not really getting involved and leaving it alone. But to see them like actively arming the mob for this violence was, it was profound to note that, to read that.
Yeah, it was really important for me to really illustrate that in a detailed way, kind of step by step, you know. So actually, when I was constructing, there's three chapters about the race massacre in the book, and I was constructing these chapters, I actually wrote this really long, kind of almost like a script. Like, I don't know if you've read any like oral history articles. It's like a big kind of internet genre of writing. I used to be like an internet blogger, so I kind of had that DNA in me a little bit. And I basically wrote almost like an oral history of the race massacre, where I took every single scrap of perspective I could find from like police reports, court testimony, National Guard reports, and obviously all the black perspectives that were available, and just sort of said, like, you know, at the courthouse at 9:30, what did all these people say happened, you know, and going forward like that. Yeah. And so it really helped me to be able to walk through logically when and why law enforcement did what they did. You know, like at one point, law enforcement could have removed Dick Rowland from Tulsa before everything popped off, which would have sort of diffused the situation. Mm-hmm. They chose not to. After the initial shootout at the courthouse, law enforcement could have essentially formed a protective perimeter around Greenwood to stop the mob from entering. But instead, as you pointed out, they deputized hundreds of people and even gave them badges and stars. And even afterwards, there is a lot of uncertainty about the number of people that were killed during the race massacre. No one really knows. But one thing I thought was interesting was that the initial estimates from city officials was really high, like in the hundreds. And then the number like gets reduced really massively, really fast in the days afterwards. Which implies to me that maybe as they saw sort of the repercussions of what was going to happen, as sort of the world became aware of this horrific event, that there was an effort at, you know, kind of trying to dilute the intensity of what they had done. But definitely that point about law enforcement is really important. It's especially important as you look forward to things, because there's actually ongoing legal action happening in Tulsa right now, seeking reparations and restitution for massacre survivors and descendants. And one of the core arguments is that the institutions that perpetuated the race massacre still exist, such as the Tulsa Police Department and the city of Tulsa. And so I think being able to explain exactly what the law enforcement did and how they did it is actually really important to ongoing conversations today about reparations.
Yeah. And to me, that's the – and we'll get to this here in a little bit, but the – profound importance of this is like, yes, this is one neighborhood that the book's about and is connected to one historical event, but this is so much more universal. This is so much more present that requires our attention. So thinking about, you know, the immediate aftermath, businesses, homes burned to the ground, people are harmed, brutalized, murdered, the event passes, and before the smoke can even clear, city investors, prospectors are already on the ground in Greenwood. What are they trying to do to ensure Greenwood doesn't come back?
Yeah, you know, for me, one of the most vivid scenes to write was about those days after the race massacre when Greenwood looked like a war zone. There's a very famous photo of the Dreamland Theater with Lula Williams owned, where the marquee is literally hanging by one fastener among all this rubble. And so you started seeing all this destruction right in the neighborhood. And right there on the street across from the destroyed black movie theater is a tent where these white real estate investors have set up this tent, sort of trying to get black folks to give them their financial information, claiming they're going to help them, which then ended up not being true at all. A lot of white real estate investors, some of whom were in the Ku Klux Klan, actually sort of coordinated this scheme to try to move black folks much further north. Greenwood is actually right next to downtown Tulsa, and so it's actually intersecting a very valuable part of the city. And so after the neighborhood was destroyed, white folks tried to buy the black folks out. That didn't work. They tried to actually pass a city ordinance that would have made it impossible to rebuild with the same structures, essentially to price them out of the neighborhood. Ultimately, that did not work because black lawyers challenged these new ordinances. And they also, I think what's really important to understand is that kind of at every step of the way, they were not sort of acting like they were the villains. They're saying they were the heroes. They're the people who were trying to help out, they so claimed. As for me, it brought up a lot of parallels with later urban development processes, whether it's urban renewal and highway construction in the 60s and 70s, whether it's gentrification today. Anytime these kind of things happen and black folks are displaced, it's always in the name of progress. It's always going to be presented in a positive light. And so for me, it was really important, again, to sort of unpack how these things are actually being discussed at the time. Because I think kind of too often when you look back at historical events, especially involving government policy like that, people might be looking for somebody kind of like twirling a mustache, being really evil. But in fact, they're probably going to be coming to you with their hand open for a handshake. You know, they're probably going to try to convince you that what they're saying is a great idea. And so throughout the book, I try to sort of illustrate that often these sort of nefarious policies were actually being initially presented as a positive thing for the people they were impacting. That was really important to me to highlight.
I think it was Cheryl Cashin that talked about like the shape shifting nature of racist policies and practices, that they're not really going away. And like, I don't know of anyone that would say, yeah, a race massacre is a neutral or a good thing. Like, I mean, this is super overt, super obvious, super clear that it's evil and wrong, but like, all like urban renewal, that sounds way better than race massacre, right? Zoning policies, that sounds, well, frankly, just real boring is what that sounds like. And so just to think about that, there's, how do we pay deep attention, not just to the like the profoundly overt tragic things, but the like the ways that we keep embedding harm at least racially muted languages. It's not urban renewal doesn't have that on the surface, right? And so say a bit about how, like, one, how, like, the on the cover of your book about it, it's the neighbor that refused to be erased. So, like, how in the immediate aftermath did the neighborhood continue to, like, protect its place? And then even as urban renewal comes down the pike a little bit later, how does the neighborhood continue to, in spite of profound forces, continue to kind of claim its spot, its place?
You know, there was a moment just a couple of weeks after the race massacre, as the white real estate guys are sort of hatching all these schemes. You know, there was this moment at the one black church that was left standing, First Baptist, where a lot of the black leaders met and started trying to strategize. And J.W. Hughes, he was the principal of the elementary school, which had been burned to the ground. He had this really amazing quote. He said, I'm going to keep what I have until I get what I lost. And that really became the mentality of Greenwood in the aftermath of the race massacre. And so, you know, black folks in the community banded together. They were able to get some outside funding from other black groups like the NAACP, which helped them to sort of fend off the efforts at buying them out. A black attorney named B.C. Franklin actually was able to prove that the effort to passed the Sydney ordinance with the restrictive building policies was unconstitutional. And so that was batted down. And I think sort of even beyond that and sort of these specific strategies, the decision to stay was very, very powerful. A lot of folks, thousands of folks had this happen to them and they said, I'm gonna stay right here. You know what I mean? And so I think that mentality is really what prompted me to want to sort of title my book with the community that refused to be erased. When you look forward in time, as you said, the efforts to constrict or harm Greenwood become a little bit more subtle. You know, I've talked a lot in the book about redlining in the 1930s and how that happened. And again, I try to get into the mechanics so you get to meet the actual agent, federal agent who came to Tulsa and decided to color the Greenwood neighborhood red of all the possible colors. Going forward after that, in the urban renewal era, the interstate came through Greenwood in the 1960s, and then urban renewal, through the war on poverty, ironically enough, came in the 1970s. And what was really striking for me actually about that is the idea that Greenwood was actually able to band together and prevent permanent destruction after the race massacre. But during, and we think about that dynamic, that's just, you know, it's these guys, semi-villainous guys who are in the Klan in Tulsa. That's like who they were battling against. And they were actually able to kind of fend those guys off. But when you fast forward to the 60s and 70s, now it's the federal government, it's Congress. You know, it's these huge institutions that have decided that black communities are ghettos, are blighted, and need to be transformed. And so that dynamic became almost too big for Greenwood to fend off. However, kind of throughout all of those challenges, there was never, I think the spirit of Greenwood never left. And I think that even if the neighbors faced a lot of setbacks at different times, there have also been so many moments throughout its history when folks have really banded together to defend it. You know, even during the era of urban renewal, when the vast majority of Greenwood was actually bulldozed, folks actually banded together to defend the black middle school. And so that middle school is actually still there in Greenwood because folks decided they were not going to let that, at least this one piece of our history, go. And so I think, you know, ultimately the narrative I crafted was a story of really massive forces trying to undermine this neighbor like so many others, but also I think a story about hope and resilience and folks coming together to defend what they can on an intimate and a human scale.
Hey guys, if you're feeling challenged by these conversations in our Voices from the Field series and are wondering how to address these realities in your own neighborhood, please reach out to us. We would love to bring FCS's experience to your neighborhood. Place-based work is complex and multifaceted, so don't go at it alone. Whether it's some one-on-one coaching or walking with us through our two-year multi-sector cohort called City Shapers, we're here for you. So reach out to us today at fcsministries.org.
I found fascinating is that there's some popular awareness of like the Green Book. Like if you're going to be in the South and you're black, here's places you can eat, stay, etc. But the Yellow Book is not really ever talked about, which is the one that's, again, in print in black and white of here's as we build the interstates. These are the neighborhoods we're going to target to put the interstates through. And like and there's no other logic other than like, this is a neighborhood that we can take. Like, I mean, you look at the, like even the shapes of the interstates in Atlanta and it's like, it's some weird lines, you know, and like, but it's not just like, oh, it's probably just the topography that needed Interstate 20 to do this weird kind of curving thing rather than be a straight line. And just see that how, again, these ongoing practices are very real, very racialized, like neighborhood by neighborhood. And I think, and again, I think with Rothstein's book, Color of Law, I think redlining is more, there's greater awareness of that than maybe before. And for even those who, let me see if I can say this. So even people who are aware of the racialized practices like redlining that were done with racial intent and racial harm, they're not trying to undermine it, ignore it. They agree that it happened. They see it. I think they still talk about like where our neighborhoods are today as just a legacy of past actions, which is true, but there's a mindset that that somewhere there was a moment in time where those actions stopped happening, and now we're just trying to clean up the mess from those actions. And I think like what you do, like through covering this 100 years of history, is like I never at one point was like, oh, that's the line in the sand where these things stopped and we just started rebuilding, right? That there's an ongoing, evolving practice of racial harm. And so as you kind of unpack this, like thinking even like in our lifespan, like late 1900s, the last 20 years of this century, like what would you say are the ongoing ways in which Greenwood is still sought to be, or other black neighborhoods in Tulsa have sought to be undermined by, whether it's private, political, nonprofit, you know, whatever forces that are still at play today?
Well, first off, Sean, I'm going to have to bite that Green Book, Yellow Book thing. That was really good. I'm like, that was a great rhetorical device. So it's going to be part of my talks from now on.
Well, it's your fault that it got stuck in my head. So I used it in a graduate course recently, and they loved it. So props to you on that one.
You know, I think in terms of the ongoing harms, you know, it's interesting because there's both. I think there are things in the physical landscape and also sort of in the cultural landscape that are both at play. First time anybody comes to Greenwood, the first thing you're going to notice is this huge highway in the middle of the neighborhood, right? There's a highway that cuts right through the center of Greenwood Avenue. It actually displaced the Goodwin family's business, the family at the center of my story. And, you know, what's interesting about that to me is the fact that the highway seemed so permanent, you know, like when you, I mean, who's ever even thought about moving a highway or how the highway got there? They're just there, you know, they're like part of, they feel like a part of nature almost.
Just a fact of life.
And so it's been very interesting for me being here for several years now to sort of had that perception of the highway when I came. And you might hear some grumbling about it, but no one thought about sort of doing anything about it, essentially. However, I think one thing about the current harms or the past harms that persist is there are some efforts now to undo some of that stuff. And so the federal government, actually, the Department of Transportation, has started a program called Reconnect the Communities that is giving federal funding to different cities to potentially remove highways or other things that really destroyed urban infrastructure, urban communities in the 60s and 70s. And Greenwood actually got a grant to explore the option, you know? And so that's actually, I think, in the epilogue of my book, I get into that a little bit. But it was important for me at least to highlight one harm that's happened that persists today that could actually plausibly be undone, you know? It's not a pie in the sky idea. So I think that's an example of a harm that continues, but, you know, we can kind of see a light in the tunnel, so to speak. Sort of on the other side of things, on the cultural side, I think there is a big, let's say, a risk of telling Greenwood's story without involving Greenwood, I guess I would say. And I think that's been a big issue here. And I also should say for me as a writer and artist in some ways, I have to be very cognizant of that for myself. You know, I'm not from Greenwood. I created this commercial product that talks about Greenwood. So I'm very cognizant of those things for myself. However, it was really interesting for me to sort of observe the way that something like Watchmen, which, you know, really brought the story of Black Wall Street, really of the race massacre, I should say, to a really wide audience a few years ago, how that was perceived here by some of the families whose lives were sort of funneled into this Hollywood soup to create the Watchmen characters, you know what I mean? And so I think that's an example of a harm that's a little bit more hidden, I guess I would say, you know? Like, because I think when you watch a show like Watchmen, your impression might be, oh, it's so amazing that we're able to sort of have this unearthed. But I think that the people who were directly harmed by the event, who have still had no recompense for it, are not involved in that process. It rings a little bit more hollow. And so I think that kind of exploitation in some ways, I think has been a really big challenge for a lot of folks here have faced. And I should also say, again, everything I'm bringing up, there's somebody here looking for a solution. You know what I mean? And so
I mentioned earlier
that there's this lawsuit going on seeking reparations. Part of the lawsuit actually is also about how museums and other institutions monetize Greenwood and basically demanding that anybody who's monetizing the story has to put money into a compensation fund, essentially, for massacre survivors and victims. And so, you know, I think for every sort of seemingly insurmountable challenge, I think maybe Hollywood can seem also as sort of impenetrable as the highway, you know? But there actually are solutions that have been proposed. It's just sort of up to us to follow through with them.
Yeah, I mean, there's an assumption of like just the kind of neutral, almost invisible forces of just how our cities take shape. Right. And to be clear, even if you don't know how, but to work out of the fundamental belief that whatever city you're in, it was designed and it's working perfectly the way that it was designed to work. Right. And if it can be designed, it can be undesigned or redesigned. Right. And even the stories of like the communities that were able to get together and fight against the interstate coming through. And for other communities, be like, wait a second, we had a choice in this. Like we could organize against this. Like how does that work exactly? And to think about if we can design our neighborhoods to be concentrated inequity. We can design neighborhoods to hoard opportunity. Like, we can also design neighborhoods to be places of equity and opportunity and belonging. And just to hear the way that that's like, again, this refusal to be erased and this continued fight for place and vibrancy that is so deserved by the residents of that neighborhood is just a profound story. And I think, you know, even historically, I think there can be an assumption of like, civil rights area, you know, all the civil rights acts that were passed in the mid to late 60s, like, you know, that's the line in the sand of when we really started to kind of come together and work together. But for most black and brown neighborhoods, like, that wasn't a line in the sand that changed neighborhood life in a substantive way. And for you, in the what kind of gives you like the most like sense of like progress or hopefulness for Greenwood's, you know, next 20 years as it thinks about the reality of the next phase of future? What gives you hope or thoughtfulness about what's next?
You know, I think there's a lot more energy, I guess I would say, that I perceive in Greenwood compared to when I first visited in 2018. You know, I think the activism of 2020 especially really galvanized the community here. You know, and there's a modern section of the book. You mentioned earlier how people can kind of draw a line in the sand in the 60s. And it was really important for me to have a modern section of this book that didn't feel like it was only about the past. You know, there are like ongoing things happening in Greenwood today that are relevant to all of us right now. And so I actually ended up following this woman named Tiffany Crutcher. She's a physical therapist. Actually, was living in Alabama several years ago when her brother was killed by the Tulsa Police Department. Tiffany ultimately moved back to Tulsa, became a big police reform activist, led a lot of protests and marches in the community. And I follow her through sort of what she experienced after George Floyd was murdered, and what she experienced when President Trump came to visit Tulsa a few weeks after that in a very contentious visit. And, you know, I think first of all, just sort of highlighting helping people reaccess the moment of 2020 is really valuable, actually. You know, that was 4 years ago now, and I think a little dreamlike for some people now to think about what was going on that year. Mm-hmm. And so I think sort of being able to have a document on this, all this stuff actually happened. We all had these experiences. We all had these memories. It's really important. But even more important than that, I think, is being able to also explain that, you know, somebody like Tiffany Crutcher has a nonprofit called the Terrence Crutcher Foundation, named after her slain brother, that works to do a lot of community engagement, like engaging with young people, helping educate them or provide after-school programs, trying to engage in the political scene. I think one thing that was really interesting, talking to Tiffany, who again, I followed for several years for this project, you know, sort of in the early stages of her activism, there was a lot of wrangling with the mayor going on, where, you know, I'd go to these meetings she was having with the mayor, and she'd be trying to convince the mayor to do XYZ thing, and he might agree to it, but then waffle, and, you know, just like political back and forth kind of stuff. And then more recently, she's told me that she's kind of pivoted to thinking much more about like community engagement, like what could I do to provide for the people in North Tulsa just on a basic human day-to-day level? And if we can do that, then that's the way we're going to actually build political power. And so political power can't really be routed through City Hall, because City Hall is, as you said, is working as intended. You know, you're not going to change the way they intend to work. But if you can get other people who are not sort of invested in that process or who don't feel represented by that process to feel that you have their back, they're much more likely to have yours. You know, I've been talking a lot as I discussed this book about the importance of like being in community with others outside of political crisis. You know, I think 2020 showed that people can respond to political crisis pretty effectively, but it also showed that when the crisis is over, the energy just dissipates. It's just gone, you know? And so I think that we have to find ways to be there for each other and care for each other outside of those moments that sort of the world stops. And I think that's what Greenwood illustrated really well after the race massacre, right? The reason that those folks were able to stay there and rebuild is because they already had a community of support and love that existed well before 1921. And so I think that dynamic of finding spaces where we can gather and support each other that are not explicitly political is actually really, really key to finding progress. And I think Greenwood is actually cultivating some of those spaces through things like there's a new coffee shop owned by a Greenwood native right there on the Greenwood Avenue. There's a lot of young entrepreneurs here who are doing cool initiatives. There's a great black digital outlet called the Black Wall Street Times that's run by a young black journalist and employs a lot of young black writers. And so I think that having those kinds of new institutions cropping up and building up is part of that path towards progress. Again, that sort of exists outside of explicit political battles.
And I'll definitely add links kind of in the show notes to the various institutions and individuals you've mentioned, just that our listeners can support and follow them as well and kind of get behind what they're working on. It's good to just I appreciate kind of what you mentioned earlier about they're not heroes, but they are like really humanizing. And that still happens today, right? Of how do we not just institutionalize figures from a black and white TV screen of back then, but say who's carrying that torch now? Like, who's doing that work now? And like, it's easy to say, well, if I'd have been here back then or whatever at this date or era, I would have functioned in this way. It's like, no, you probably function exactly who you are now. Like, who are you supporting? Where are you engaging? And not just the flashpoints of major emotional kind of national consciousness or trauma, but just in the day in, day out kind of grind of connection. I want to ask you one more question, and it's really about kind of your hope for the impact of the book, right? I mean, it's in one way you could say this is a very hyper-specific book about one neighborhood in one city with one historic event and the prelude and the aftermath of that event. I've never been to Greenwood. I'll be there later this year for the first time, but like, I didn't even know I was going to be there when I bought the book and read it, right? And so, like, to me, what I'm reading here is, like, I don't care if you ever visit Oklahoma in your life, you need to read this. So I'm curious from your perspective that what's the universal, what's the bigger story that you're hoping as readers get into this, what are you hoping reframes in their mind as they think about the world they're in today, right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing I hope anybody reads this understands, no matter where they are, is that the world that we're in today is not static and it's not permanent. You know, it's been shaped by all of these forces that predate it, both in terms of the physical landscape and I think the internal landscape of the people who live in it. You know what I mean? I think for me, for example, when I first came here, I would sometimes go to these city council meetings and other sort of government meetings, and there would just be this rawness with a lot of the black residents and engaging with city officials. And it was like really raw, and it was really common. And sometimes people can look at that and say, like, why are you being so emotional? Like, why are you so upset? Like, you know, we're trying to get something done. What are you doing? You know? And I think that when you sort of understand the full scope of what's happened across generations, that rawness makes a lot more sense. And so I think being able to explain not only how the physical landscape is in this place, but how the people's psyches have been shaped by all these challenges they've faced is really important to being able to understand, no matter where you live, how are you going to be able to engage with people who are not like you in your community, you know, for example. And so I think for me, at least, it's really about that, just being able to sort of reevaluate how we got here in a lot of ways. You know, the book isn't super prescriptive. You know, I think in the epilogue, I talk about reparations and some of my ideas about how that could be done. I think that conversation is easily Googleable in a lot of ways. You know what I mean? If you want to know reparations, there's lots out there to learn about it. For me, it was much more important to be able to say, like, here is the story of a community and the people in it and how they sort of operate as an ecosystem together. And, you know, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned about how these things function, because in a lot of ways, Greenwood is sort of perceived as this hyper unique story, like so much black wealth, so much destruction. But all the beasts that happened there happened everywhere else. So no matter where you're from, I think you can find those parallels with your own community. And then think about, you know, where your history fits into that, but also what you can do now to change your community in a positive way.
Yeah, and I would want anyone with a pulse to be reading this story that you've told so powerfully. In the particular world I operate in, it's in like place-based, neighborhood-based organizations that are trying to work towards racial equity, poverty alleviation. That's kind of the world that we're in, and so like, not all, but most of those neighborhoods are predominantly black or brown, right? And so I think. Even in the industry of people who understand the racialized harm in the past, who want to see racial equity happen, there's still kind of a mindset about neighborhoods that, like, to your story about people that raw emotion stuff. There, I think there's this mindset of like the neighborhoods are kind of like puzzles, right? Like through racialized disinvestment, there's just some pieces missing, and we just need to put the piece of affordable housing in, or kind of put the piece of some business, you know, investment in. And it's like, I'm not against the housing or the business investments, right? But to recognize that this is an ecosystem that's had a long story before the well-intentioned organization came to partner with them, right? And so, like, for me, I'm like, I want everybody to read this, but especially if you're in the neighborhood business, especially if you're partnering with Black and Brown neighborhoods, like, this is a story you need to read to recognize. It may not be the story of where you are, but, like, it teaches you to see in a whole lot more just textured way that this is a three-dimensional, living and breathing and never not changing ecosystem that you're stepping into. And for me, like, it gave me a whole new, I feel like my eyes were opened in a different way, kind of being in historic South Atlanta, which is also the site of a race massacre that happened in 1906 mm-hmm. in Atlanta. And so it's like it's much more living. It didn't feel like a history book per se, but it felt like something so much more living to realities of where we are. So, man, just so grateful for this book. I imagine that had to be like mentally, emotionally, physically quite the lift for you to take on. I just am grateful that you would do that and give that gift to the world, and also just really grateful for your time today that you join us in this conversation. So, Victor, thank you. This has just been a delight and a privilege to talk to you today.
Well, yeah, thanks so much, Sean. I really appreciate being able to have the convo. And when you're here in Greenwood, hit me up. We should hang out.
Oh, I will absolutely do it. It will be beyond my primary task to accomplish when I come.
Sounds good.
If you have appreciated this conversation, I would encourage you to pick up Built from Fire, 100 Years in the Neighborhood That Refused to Be Erased, wherever books are sold. Please also follow the links in the show notes to learn more about Atlanta's 1906 race massacre. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission it is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you would like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in the show notes. If you would like to watch these episodes, the videos can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you like this episode, please share it on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rhodes with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park, Becca Klein, and Rose Silva at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. We would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment, Inc., whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.